Welcome to this podcast series asking the question, can art save us? I'm starting the first national and international conversation about courage and curiosity. What do these qualities really mean and why does it make a big difference to our mental, societal and democratic health? I talk to award-winning and diverse artists across the arts to explore these qualities in their lives and work, both to inspire and for us all to learn. I'm exploring why we need these qualities to help change the global epidemic of mental illness, loneliness, polarisation of our communities, and even global conflict. If the arts cultivate courage and curiosity, I'm asking the question, can art save us? Have you ever unexpectedly had a conversation with someone that you've never met before, but it's as though you've always known them? Their heart isn't just on their sleeve, it's front and centre. In fact, it's handed to you, still beating, whilst their stories unravel and poetry is in motion. That's what happened when I met my guest today, a gifted poet, David Attree. I think of Dave as a people's poet. He's also known as a poet chef, Famous Dave, and more recently as the voice of the week in words, aired on BBC Radio across three counties. You'll also see his poetry on buses in the city of Brighton, also known internationally as a centre of creativity. But fame isn't what interests Dave, it's connection, it's you. Dave's BBC on-air introduction was clear from the start. I'm not writing for a crowd. He's interested in every individual that makes up a community. He finds hope in disguise and he takes the time to measure what really counts. Dave links news and stories with poems and rhymes. He creates a calm space where we can stop and think and even time can rest a while. Dave is also an active poet in other ways. He walks and cycles for charitable causes. He speaks up with us and for us. He's also a funeral celebrant, and is it any wonder? Compassion tumbles out of Dave so fast, I doubt his poetry can keep up. He celebrates a person's life as though he has always known them, with the skill and insight that poets possess. And what lies behind it all? Courage. Dave knows tragedy and fear. He's had life-saving surgery that sadly many don't make, and he's also recovered from a stroke. Through all this, he serves the value of life for all of us, and he champions his amazing Paralympian daughter too. This is a family that isn't shy of beating the odds. Dave lets you know you are heard amongst all the noise. He invites you to pause, and I'm sure, like me, you'll feel you've always known him too. Hello, Dave.
Hello. I like the sound of me.
I like the sound of you too. Yay.
And I say that with zero ego. It's just actually just a little reminder of things I do and how I think. And this is absolutely that kind of example that when we first met, there was a little connection. I'm like, I think you kind of get me and what I stand for. And absolutely, I'm getting that feel from you. It's fantastic. I'm so happy to be chatting to you.
Oh, it's lovely. And thank you for making the time, because it is so nice, isn't it, when chat and conversation is so easy. And I think we've said before, it's a sad thing that the art of conversation is disappearing. We don't really chat much or chat to each other anymore.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that this, without sounding too cliched, I think with social media and things like that, everything's kind of sound bites and headlines and, you know, kind of the old elevator pitch, 30 seconds, that feels like, that's like a, I don't know, a kind of War and Peace now, isn't it? Everything has to be condensed. You have to catch somebody's eye, get a point across, move on, bang, because people are just scrolling. And I just think the art of conversation, it's just such a natural thing. It's a primeval thing, right? We used to gather around a fire and there used to be somebody sat there that was very good at telling stories, and they were kind of venerated and kind of held aloft in society as somebody that like shared information and you could kind of go to and kind of share a discourse with and chat and learn from. And every interaction, any conversation that you have with somebody that you already know really well or that you've just met for the first time, you can learn something from them and you can share things. And yeah, it's just, conversation always fascinates me. I am, you know, I've said before, I'm that guy on the train that chats to people. Yeah, because I'm just like, why would you not? There are stories swirling around us all over the place. And it's just like, I just love finding them.
Yeah, and it's just such important stuff for social cohesion and a sense of community, isn't it? And
100%, yeah.
And no doubt you've commented in terms of your week in words only just this morning for BBC Regional Radio, and I wondered what you may have reflected on today.
Yeah, well, today the whole premise of the Week in Words originally when BBC reached out to me, that they've, fair play to them, they've given me just kind of carte blanche and said, actually, just record something for us. We trust you. Yeah, I appreciate there are certain parameters. It can't be political. It can't be, you know, naturally, it can't be kind of, you know, provocative or anything like that. And that's not me anyway. So, but the idea was it was to kind of do a bit of a review of the weekly news, yeah, in Surrey and Sussex and Kent and maybe further afield. But when I was sitting down to actually gather stories and look at things, there was a weight to everything that I was reading, and it was kind of crushing, really, because the news stories, well, you could argue since kind of 2016 when something significant happened, and actually global events in the last kind of 2-3 years have just been so tragic and sad, and we're now hearing numbers rather than names of people that are no longer around, and that's a daily count, you know, like we had during lockdown. It was like the daily figures, and these are all individuals that are no longer here, you know. So that was, it was quite a weight, it was quite hard to write about that on a weekly basis. And I was thinking, well, I can't ignore it. Yeah, you can't have a Week in the Words feature and not address what's been happening in the world. But I think my responsibility with the piece and the project is to maybe put people in a place where they can hear something, yeah, spoken directly from me to them, because I write for an individual. That's how good radio works. You just hear it. They're just the other person's just talking to you. And actually maybe kind of give them to something to, for a bit of hope or a bit of just a little smile or maybe a bit of laughter here and there. But Sunday's a precious day because it's that kind of crossroads day. Yeah, you've got to the end of a week, so you're reflecting on that, but you're also conscious of the fact that you're just heading into the new week. And Sunday can be a bonus day because there's no, you know, plans, and you don't have to do loads of stuff, and you don't have to, you know, specifically have to be anywhere. So you've got that kind of freedom of thought sometimes. So I see the Week in Words as a piece that can maybe hopefully remind people there's more. Well, today's piece ended with "there's always more good than bad," and maybe just give a few kind of pointers and a few kind of things to smile about, really, because I think it's, smiling is such a powerful and needed thing right now.
Yeah, I it really does stand out. This is very consistent in your work. So in the last couple of weeks, if people wanted to catch up on BBC Sounds, for example, you're not shy, and to use your words, of reflecting on the non-stop heavy bombardment of news. You're hyper aware of the humanitarian crisis that exists in the world today, but you're equally aware of the fact, and using your words again, new shoots will grow and light will always come. And it seems to me you're putting in a really crucial and essential reminder for that need of balance in the world and in our lives.
Yeah, I agree. I think with you know, news is now available 24 hours a day, as we know, and I think it's really easy just to sink into it, and almost like a quicksand of news, of just tragic, sad news, and that has to have an effect, even though you know that's not you, that's not your family. You can just switch over. Sometimes, you know, I find myself, it feels awful, but switching over from the news because I can't watch it. Yeah, and I just think I've got that choice. Yeah, and that feels bad. Yeah, that actual action feels bad. But I think that there is so much bad news, and on a, not a cynical level, on a practical level, bad news is always sold, right? The tabloids feed off it, I guess, and have done very well from that. People will always kind of chat more about a negative story sometimes than a positive story. So I see my role with my writing is just to try and engage and try and find the positives, not glibly, not without any kind of substance, but actually genuinely find things that actually could really matter to somebody, or really be a positive spin on something, or just, yeah, give an opportunity to really think about, actually, we hear so much bad stuff, but you know, there's yet to be a channel set up just for good news. But I think if a channel was set up just for good news, it would be crammed, because there's people out there making a difference. You're making a difference with this podcast, reminding people how vital the arts is and how what a role it plays in our society. And, you know, just on the basics during lockdown, what did people go back to? They went back to music. They went back to reading. They went back to art. And they found a way to actually learn those skills themselves. Yeah, because they'd been afforded or forced to have that time to think, oh, actually, maybe I could pick up a guitar, or maybe I could play a piano. And yeah, we naturally go back to the arts. It's so fundamental for our well-being and our kind of mental state of mind and health. And yet, yeah, as you champion and share and fair play to you for doing it, yeah, there is such a lack of understanding and a lack of funding for it that it's just it feels like a huge opportunity is potentially being missed. Yeah, for people to really, really invigorate their lives with these kind of skills and hearing new voices and sounds.
Yeah, absolutely. And for example, referring to you as a people's poet, it's also an important acknowledgement of how we can all have a relationship with the arts without the arts having to carry some kind of elitist tag. It is for everybody. And it's really more about increasing and widening our understanding of how and why the arts have such a critical role in our lives in different ways. And one of the things I think your work does is raise conscious thought. You actually really work hard at reminding people to create a positive space around their own thinking. And that can be as simple as reminding people to take a pause. And recently, I really liked how you imagined that we could actually change the idea of a week. And it was something I wanted to touch on, because it's actually really significant. We all follow, or most of us follow, the Gregorian calendar. It brings a structure to our year, but it's also how we structure our minds. So I was wondering if you'd like to comment on your idea of, imagine if we actually changed the idea of a week or a calendar.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's strange, you know, through this project on the BBC, it's taken me off in some fairly strange kind of tangents and wibbly wobbly kind of directions. But when I sat down last week, I was reminded of something that I'd seen. It's just like a Facebook interaction or a social media interaction. And somebody just said, oh, wouldn't it be just so nice if we just had 4 weeks to every month and every month was the same? And then somebody said, yeah, but then, you know, leap years would be kind of all screwed up and, you know, it would all be tricky and da da da. And it just been ticking away in my head. And I just thought, well, yeah, how would it be if every month started on Sunday the 1st? Yeah, and you just had 4 weeks and that was it. It would all be nicely neat and packaged and you know exactly what was going on. And obviously, yeah, leap years would be slightly different. Every couple of years, you'd need an extra day, but maybe that could be a day to where everyone stops and just looks back on the achievements that they've made over the last couple of years or whatever. And we just have a catch-up day. Yeah, we could just call it that, you know, catch-up day, or pop round to your neighbour's day. I don't know, make a cup of tea for a stranger day. Just a different kind of take on things. And but then when I started to kind of look into it, I was just like, oh, actually, if you have a, you probably know, if you have a, you know, the 1st of the month is a Sunday, then you will have a Friday the 13th. So basically I'd be, yeah, proposing to, it wouldn't get very far this one, you'd have 13 Friday the 13th. So can you imagine the Friday the 13th on the 13th month of the year?
And I do think that superstition probably does overrule faith and religious belief, probably.
Yes. Absolutely. And especially that Friday the 13th, it's always intrigued me. Even as a kid, I'd be that one asking the questions about things, and they'd be like, oh, just don't ask that. Why? Because it's a valid question. I'd be like, why is Friday the 13th unlucky? Yeah. And people would be like, I don't know. It just is. Mm. I'm like, okay, right. I'm just going to walk around this ladder and then we'll have a chat about it after that, you know? Mm. And it's, yeah, it's just like, where do these things kind of come from? But that just become inherent in our kind of societal structure.
No, that's right.
So I just kind of played with it. I riffed with it and it seemed to land quite well. I had a few kind of comments and messages on the back of last week's because it was a fun thing to do. And I actually discovered I tend to kind of delve a little bit, I think, as you do, that Kodak, a very, very large and successful company, had actually used the 4-week calendar for many years, about kind of 50 or 60 years. Mm-hmm. And their staff were contracted into that calendar, although they used the Gregorian outside of work. But yeah, and I think they only gave that up in like the 60s or 70s or something. It was a quite a long-standing part of the Kodak kind of setup, which just made me, I just found that fascinating. So yeah, just in angles, you know?
Yeah, it's really interesting, but it is what you're doing. You're just raising a conscious awareness of the structures we live by and actually maybe step back and take some time to think about that. And I was wondering if we could go from the idea of changing a week or indeed the calendar to life-changing events, which you know only too well. So without assuming how much you want to talk about that or how close you want to go to some of those stories, I'm interested in when life really changed for you, or in fact, we could say when life started, because you discovered life for you wasn't in fact a given.
No, absolutely. The experience that I'll mention now absolutely was life-changing, but not in that kind of dramatic kind of cliche way. It changed my life, and it's why we're having a chat now. But last year I hit 50, which was like great. And I had all the funny cards and all the kind of jokes and the ribbing and stuff. But in my head, I turned 20 because April the 24th last year was the 20th anniversary of, life-saving surgery. I had a very large aortic aneurysm, which was starting to show signs of fraying. And I needed surgery very quickly. And I discovered that I had that because tragically I lost my cousin to a condition called Marfan syndrome, which I have and I live with, as does my mum and my auntie, because it's a dominant gene. So if you have a child, it's 50-50, whether they have it or not. So and in our family line, we got unlucky quite a few times. I'd lost lovely cousin Peter. And then face this kind of surgery. I went to see a consultant, my employer at the time, because I was doing good things for them, said, look, go and see him privately. I'm like, that's not really for me. Thank you. That's kind. And they're like, no, we've booked you an appointment. So I saw him and he held up a scan that I'd had. And I'm like, oh, is that my heart? And he's like, no, that's your aorta.
Wow.
It should not be that size.
Wow.
And you have 4 weeks. It's weird. I always pause when I get to this because
it's fine. All the time you need.
It's good. I've got a cat on my lap and she's looking at me and purring, which is always that. It's all right, Dad. Keep going. I had the surgery 6 weeks earlier than I would have seen the same consultant on the NHS.
Oh, no.
So on those decisions, sliding door moments, all those kind of things. Yeah, it's just like, so you can kind of understand why I have that positivity and energy because I'm alive, right? Mm. So last year, I devised, curated, performed that, and ran a show called Alive in Brighton, and I celebrated being alive. But I also acknowledged cousin Peter, because last year was, I can actually, hand on heart now, say last year was the first year when it came to his birthday and it came to the anniversary of his passing and his daughter's birthday as well, when I wasn't. I don't want to say overwhelmed because it sounds far too dramatic. I wasn't intensely conscious of the kind of survivor's guilt because it was going to be me or him. Yeah. And I got really lucky. So I truly feel I have an obligation and a duty to engage, to find people's stories, to entertain if I can, and just to share stories and just the wonder that is all around us. It's that pure. It's that simple. It really is.
And this, of course, was particularly pronounced because your cousin, you were literally a couple of days apart, weren't you?
Yeah, two days different in our birthdays. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So he should have had his 50th last year, you know. So it was, that was tough. Yeah, but actually there is much to be celebrated. He was a lovely, lovely guy. And actually last year, as I say, he formed a part of the piece that I opened the Alive show with, and he was acknowledged and he was celebrated.
Yeah.
You know, and actually I owe him, I've switched from thinking, God, I'm alive because he isn't, to actually, do you know what, Peter, I'm alive and I have you to thank for that.
Yeah.
Because you can't beat that kind of fate. It was going to happen. It happened. So my responsibility is to kind of have in my mind, but not let that kind of, you know, stop me making kind of creative decisions or happy decisions, and just acknowledge the fact that I'm so, so lucky.
Yeah. Because I know we've mentioned before how tragedy and grief it's mm-hmm. complex and it's multi-layered. You know, the idea of survivor's guilt, for example. But as you were saying, also honouring and remembering somebody. And so at the time of this life-changing event coinciding with the loss of Peter, and I understand even more complex than that, because your mother, in fact, was going through the surgery prior to you undertaking the surgery.
Yeah. So
you know,
yeah.
This is an unimaginable scale of risk you were negotiating, because I know you were courageous enough.
Mm-hmm.
To not burden your mum with the worry that you were going to do the surgery as soon as possible yourself.
Yeah, I had to lie. She was taken ill. We all went for tests for Marfan and had heart scans and stuff. And while mum was waiting for her results, she became poorly and she was rushed in, and she had a bypass and aortic valve replacement and mitral valve repair as well. So she was up in Yorkshire. And I went up to see her. On the ward, and she was very tired and not in a great space. And she's like, "Have you had your test? What's happening with you?" And I had to lie and basically said, "Oh, I'm just I've had a test. I'm just waiting on results. Don't worry about it. I feel fine." Because at the time, I looked different. Yeah, I was a different physique. I was very healthy. I was boxing. Which stopped instantly. Mum had her surgery. I think it was about a month and a half before mine. So it was an intense time, let's just say. But I had a mantra in my mind when I was facing the surgery, and facing it with Sarah, my brilliant, brilliant wife. Because I think it's just as tough for the partners, if not tougher, because they're just like looking on. They're not directly affected, but they are, completely affected. And I had a mantra in my mind that my first conscious thought would be, I'm no longer ill. I'm now getting better. Yeah. And that was when I came round, and it was all a bit woozy and strange. But that was my first conscious thought.
Yeah. It's incredible, because positive affirmation is consistent in your work, but it's also quite an incredible and tough discipline. When you're in that context of all that stress, as one example, you know, to still be able to assert positive affirmation is quite a strength. You have shown so much courage. I'm curious whether you understand some of your own actions and attitudes as courageous, even?
Probably not, to be honest with you. I mean, there's a couple of things that, if my daughter was hearing me now, she'd be rolling her eyes, but she's not. She's in Dubai, warm weather training, and then competing with Team GB, as you do.
Wow.
But we'll come on to her, right?
But I
just got these like two basic things that that always come into my head pretty much every day, which is kind of focus on what you can do rather than what you can't. Simple, right? But that's quite powerful. And that helped me in the recovery from that. It certainly helped me last year. You touched on it earlier on. I had a stroke last year out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So last year was, super, super tough. And that was a month before the Alive show. So the fact that I managed to, still happen was incredible. But also, there's another thing that I truly live by, which is you wake up, if you're lucky, you wake up in the morning and you've got a certain amount of energy and you can choose to use that energy during the day. And if you choose to use that energy only on things you can affect, you're great. Yeah. If you choose to use that energy on things you cannot affect, you are consciously choosing to waste that energy.
Yeah.
And it's simple. Yeah. And it's pure, but I live by that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, right, what can I do today? What can I affect today? Acknowledge what you can't affect.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just use all your energy into the good stuff.
Yeah, it's a very, very crystal clear compass, isn't it? And alive is something I do want to talk about. But just before moving on to that, what I'm also curious about is, when did poetry become a part of you? I'm wondering whether it already was part of your life, and was it perhaps part of your coping strategy through these particular life-changing events? Or is it something that came later?
Since I was a kid, I've always loved rhythm. I've always loved words. There are some words I just love the sound of. Yeah. And the bounciness of spoken word, I absolutely love. It's kind of how my mind works. I'd always written poems as a kid, really, really like them. But, it's strange because we keep using that word today. And I often refer to it as the P word, because I find that if I say, oh, what do you do, Dave? Oh, well, I work, but I'm also a spoken word performer. I'm a writer and a storyteller. And they're like, oh, great. Tell me more about that. And if I say, I write and I'm a poet. And they're like, oh, that's interesting. And you can just see them glazing. So I call it the P word, because I think at school, poetry is one of those subjects that I think there's a compulsion to kind of teach it. But my experience of it has been that it's disseminated and destructed, basically. It's like, let's take this one line of poetry, analyze every syllable, and then put it back together again and work out what it means. Yeah. Rather than, does that bounce? Does that say something to you? What do you think's going on there? You know what I mean? It's just, yeah. So poetry, I jokingly refer to as the P word, but I have to acknowledge that, you know, each week I'm being called a poet on radio and stuff like that. So I'll roll with it. but I've always written. I've always had that mindset.
But
it ramped up a few years ago. I was doing a job that I wasn't really truly enjoying. And Sarah, who I've mentioned before, and I could, yeah, do a separate podcast now, because she is just joyous and brilliant and so supportive. She just said, stop.
Yeah.
Just stop. Take time away. Yeah. Kind of heal a bit, because there were things that I was still kind of dealing with people after all those years. Get well, get better, and just focus on writing and create and write and do things. And I did. And, you know, here we are chatting.
Yeah. And it's having permission, isn't it? And what a joy when there's a partner or someone close to you that recognizes the need to have that permission and to support it. So even though poetry, or the P word, was always part of you, would you say that when the landmark year of 2023 arrived, be it the anniversary of not turning 50, but turning 20.
Yeah.
But also, you know, the chances of experiencing a stroke in that year, almost reinforcing all of the life affirmations that you're so committed to, and that feeding into your event Alive.
Absolutely. Bizarrely, it might sound funny for people to kind of hear this, but I see the heart surgery and everything around that and the recovery from that as being the reason that last year didn't completely break me. Because having a stroke age 49, you know, 20 years on from having a very attention-seeking, noisy fuss, you know, previously on a medical side, it just felt like kind of, yeah, I did have thoughts. It was just like, you're not meant to be here, right? Yeah, tried it at 29, getting to 30, that's not going to happen. Oh, no, you made it. Okay, let's just tick along and wait a bit. You're 49 now. You're getting ready to celebrate your 50th. Right, let's just have some more. Yeah, it came completely out of the blue. I was, very, again, very, very healthy, training for a 100-mile ride for Alzheimer's Society, all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden I have a stroke out of the blue. But I think because of what I'd experienced with the loss of Peter and the recovery from heart surgery and various other things that had happened in the intervening years, I was in a much better place to understand how I might feel after the stroke and to have those coping strategies. Yeah. Whereas if I'd just not had anything like that before and then last year had happened, it would have been probably harder. But I would say I acknowledge and have shared with friends that last year was the toughest year of my life. Yeah, it was beyond heart surgery year.
Yeah, which is saying something, isn't it? When that was so enormous.
Yeah, but I saw that. It's a strange thing. I saw that as a mechanical thing because I saw the image. I'm like, that's my aorta. It's three times the size it should be. You're going to put a metallic valve into my heart. I will tick every heartbeat. I hear a tick. Yeah, I can hear myself ticking. And that's a reassurance. Yeah. So it was a mechanical fix. It was a clumsy metaphor, but like taking your car into a garage and getting it fixed, right? I was fixed. I was no longer ill. I was now getting better. Whereas the stroke was just like, what the hell was that? How could that happen? Yeah, I take warfarin because I have a metallic heart valve. So I take anti-blood clotting medicine and have done for 20 years. Physiologically, I should not be able to have a stroke. And yet I had a blood clot in my brain. How can that happen? Yeah, so you can probably imagine the thought processes around that time.
Yeah, yeah. The impact is gigantic.
Yeah. But again, I had that positive approach to it because just like, well, again, that classic thing, use energy on things you can affect.
Yeah. And you can really see the psychological power of that. And in fact, you know, talking about poetry, you know, there is a really good book called Your Brain on Art, and it quite often refers to poetry, you know, that it dates back to at least 4,300 years ago, that, you know, in terms of actual recordings. The ancient Greeks literally prescribed poetry, and here we are today, kind of increasingly talking about social prescribing. But what's significant about that is the actual research on poetic emotion, that you can measure biological and psychological effects. And so I wonder how much your own poetry was part of your survival. And in 2023, with that shock and impact of a stroke, I wonder whether it even played into the idea of neuroplasticity.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Because I again, in terms of trying to remind myself what had happened, I mean, I said to people at the time, I've been incredibly unlucky, but I feel like I've landed on the lucky side of unlucky, right? And so there were some times when my friends were like, Dave, can't you just be pissed off once? You know what I mean? Can't you just be like, this is really unfair. I don't like this. I'm like, well, I could, but I'd be wasting energy because it's happened. Yeah, so why waste that energy? I've landed on the lucky side of unlucky. The only physical symptom of my stroke was my eyesight. And I said, again, that sounds very glib, doesn't it? But yeah, my eyesight was not great. So I was just like, okay, am I going to drive again? Am I going to be seeing stuff well again? You know, it's quite a big deal. So I just thought, right, I'll take a little diary and I'll give myself a percentage score every single day because I know that neuroplasticity works. My daughter, you mentioned earlier on, is a Paralympian. She has cerebral palsy. And she's working with a clinic in Hove, the Nicky Penny Clinic, and they do neuroplasticity in their physiotherapy. So literally retraining the brain to kind of fire different synapses in different ways. So she can actually engage muscles that previously had been redundant or previously had been affected by cerebral palsy kind of spasming and that tightening because she's a wheelchair racer. So she needs to be able to move her arms relatively quickly. So I know it can happen. So I was just thinking, okay, my brain, I don't understand how brains work, but I know my brain will suddenly realize that I'm not seeing too well. And the bit that was doing that is now dead. So there'll be parts of my brain that'll be like, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, that's how it works. And it's incredible. So I just thought, if I score that on a daily basis, let's see what happens. And well, I saw those percentages improve.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. And just for the listeners, in case you're too modest, as you are, to say, A, your daughter has a fabulous name. So Fabienne, but known as Fab. Yes. I mean, what a great start to the day.
Everyone knows her as
Morning Fab. Fab.
Yeah, Team GB, they call her Fabs. Yeah, she's Fabs. Yeah,
that's a great start. But also, I do want to let the listeners know that Fab is a double European and world champion medal holder. So your family, you don't muck about, do you?
Well, no, I guess it's weird, isn't it? I'm kind of taking a step back. And I was like, if I was listening to this, they're right. They got stuff going on. But as I say, she's in Dubai as we're chatting and she's competing today. It's a Paralympic year. And the last couple of years, she's current double European champion at 100 meter and 800 meters. She got, Team GB got a gold, silver, bronze at the Commonwealth Games in the 100 meters final. And she was that bronze. And then the World Championships last year in July, which I set myself as a goal to be physically present at and managed to achieve, and turned into a crumbly mess after her race. There was a Team GB gold, silver, bronze again, and again she was the bronze. So international level, she's up there. She's kind of third in the world. There's basically three or four athletes battling out for kind of silver, bronze at the moment. She's in that mix. And
Fab.
Exactly. She's awesome. She's absolutely incredible. I've said to her several times, if I wasn't your dad, I'd be a fan.
Yeah.
I'd be following you because she's brilliant.
Yeah. It's such a lovely and another positive affirmation story, which is so important. And, you know, it's something you're both sharing in terms of the direct experience of neuroplasticity, that we are able to create new pathways, new neuro pathways. And again, that this is one of the significant roles the arts play. And because of your work as a spoken word artist and poetry, it does seem that this is something to learn from. That if people wanted to choose, for example, poetry as a way of practicing, rehearsing, extending their own neural pathways around language, linguistics, imagination, curiosity, imagination.
Absolutely.
How significant would you say the results are by having that engagement?
I think it'd be absolutely huge. I think the potential for any person to just write one line, just whatever's in their mind, just write one line and then look at it. And then for me, spoken word is kind of my main thrust. Everything has a little rhythm or a little tick or a little overlap somewhere to it. So that tends to be how my mind works. And it's almost impossible for me now to write down the first line of something, even though I'm sending something an email. If it's got a little rhythm to it, I find it so hard not to make the second line just kind of merge a little bit and play around. But I think, if people just did that almost as like a 5-minute meditation each day, just like write down a couple of things that have happened to you today, but then try and put a couple of lines in between those and make them bounce a bit and try and pick out a tiny little rhyme from one of the words, but don't have it at the end of the, don't do classic poetry as we were taught at school we don't need that. It can just bounce and flow along. And I think with the, if we think of Ardy down in, a young lad from Hove who's now kind of absolutely smashing it out with kind of the grime scene and stuff like that. People like storytelling. They like fast paced, bouncy stories being told, and that's poetry just as much as anything else that you can find in some of the kind of the classic books. I just think if everyone just had like 5-10 minutes each day almost to do what I'm doing with the Week in Words, just to just jot down a few things and play around with stuff and just give themselves that freedom to like breathe and explore and just be daft maybe and write things down. It opens up channels in your mind that normally you don't allow yourself time to have.
Yeah. And I really do think this is where the power of your particular work comes in, your emphasis on pausing and space and reflecting. And it's really significant because, there is active neurological, psychological research which explores both the arts and specifically poetry. And you hit the nail on the head that it's identifying that the arts or poetry is helping to induce a safe meditative space. And that's where a lot of healing lies, particularly if you're recovering from trauma.
Absolutely. And I think that the power of poetry, prose, spoken word, whatever, I think the incredible thing for me, and I've experienced this with Poetry Takeaway, is you've got little time and not as many lines, but you can condense some incredibly powerful concepts, ideas, and scenery into those lines. And I think people that maybe are kind of new to poetry or spoken word, sometimes they read a couple of those lines. And for me, poetry is a visual thing. So you're almost prompting somebody to see the scene that you're portraying, yeah, with through a very few words. So the actual experience is much larger than the words on the page, because you're prompting images in people's minds. So you're actively engaging their brains, not through the physical process of reading or understanding the words or trying to work out what's going on. But more often than not, if it's written well or if it's spoken well, people can actually see what's being described. Yeah, so their brains are actively engaging and seeing these images. For me, when I write, really, sometimes really, really clearly, I can see what I'm writing, yeah. You know, and that's that can only be a healthy thing, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And just allowing for the fact that we all respond differently. And so, for example, talking therapy doesn't work for everybody, but something visual might. And a quote of yours I noted was when you said poetry condenses complex things into a few lines, or indeed into a few visual images or ideas. And I wondered if you would say that summarizes the art of poetry.
I think it does. Yeah, I think it does. I think you could write reams and reams and reams on a subject, but likewise, somebody with maybe a different way of thinking about it could just turn that into, I don't know, you could fit that on one A4 sheet, yeah, and get the same points across and get the same images set up in the reader's mind. And I think that's why, yeah, going back to what we were saying about the modern age we live in and all our rush and our headline grabbing and our attention span, I think poetry now is probably more relevant than ever, because you can get a hell of a lot across in a very short space of time. Yeah. And it's, you know, I've got a poem on a bus pooting around Brighton at the moment. People are popping on and off the bus. They might read it in the time that they're on the bus for a journey, and then they pop off again. And if some of them are now thinking about chalk and what it's made of, great. You know, if some of them engage with it and go, not for me, that's fine. At least they've had a read. But they've seen images and they've been prompted to have a think. And I think poetry can do that in a way that, it's precious to me. But I think anything, anything within the arts can fulfill that same role as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And so all of this, of course, feeds into the brilliant event that we've referenced in the conversation, Alive, which you put on incredibly in 2023, considering what you'd been through. And this was also in collaboration with the legend Whispering Bob Harris.
And lovely Bob.
Yeah, and for listeners, I'm fortunate enough to have international listeners. Whispering Bob Harris is very well known, really, as a BBC radio legend in the famous music program, of course, the Old Grey Whistle Test. And I was amazed to read that what you had in common was that Bob too had successful life-saving surgery for aortic dissection. So I wondered what you could tell us about your collaboration and the events.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I met Bob. I'm closely affiliated with a charity called the Aortic Dissection Charitable Trust, who were only set up about 2.5 years ago, but have already made absolutely massive strides forward in sharing kind of knowledge and awareness of aortic dissection and what to look for, especially in young patients, because we're losing quite a lot of young people each year, like Cousin Peter, that it was misdiagnosed and completely missed and then became very poorly. So they are doing incredible work, absolutely amazing work, and Bob is their kind of main ambassador, because he had an aortic tear So he became very poorly, and he was dissecting. So he had surgery to recover from that, and it's still something that he talks very openly about. In terms of there are days when it still really, really gives him a massive wobble. But Bob, as you know, is a great talker. He's very erudite, but he's got all these tales and stories and brilliance. And we met doing some recording for the charity and kind of just got on anyway, because his best friend in the world is Robert Plant. And in my world, the best band ever to grace the planet with Led Zeppelin. So we had plenty to chat about over lunch one time, and we kind of stayed in touch. So, which again was that kind of surreal thing, because basically through spoken word and chatting, I'd done a bit with the charity and their launch and stuff. And I was thinking, I'm having lunch with Bob Harris, and you know, here we are chatting about just similar experiences. So we kind of stayed in touch. And when I decided that I wanted to celebrate being alive and gather kind of comedy and music and spoken word together at this event, I reached out to him. I said, look, I'm thinking about doing this. If we made this a fundraiser for ADCT, Aortic Dissection Charitable Trust, would you be up for it? And he just came back straight away and said, yes, 100%. Let me know. So yeah, it was an evening of conversation with Bob and some of his tales, and between us we put together like a fantasy band, and it was the perfect way to celebrate being alive. The irony was I was running at about 60%, because it was just over a month after a stroke, so I kind of got through it, but I had a huge smile on my face, and it all went really well. But it was a great way. It was the perfect way to honour Cousin Peter, and to acknowledge that I am alive and I have a duty.
Yeah, and it's just a lovely example of the power of the arts of storytelling and of sharing and collaborating. I mean, Bob Harris has probably one of the most famous and distinct voices in the
world. 100%.
Yeah. And isn't it lovely that despite all of his legendary years in music, he is very down to earth and very willing to take part in these causes. Yeah.
100%. The man has absolutely no ego at all. It's weird, isn't it? I'm just thinking about it now as I'm chatting to you. I realize that one of the things that we share is an absolute passion for what we do. Yeah, he loves his job. He does the country show on Radio 2. He's touring. Yeah, the songs the Beatles gave away. He's out there. He's just busy, busy, busy all the time. But because he loves it, he loves hearing stories. He loves sharing stories. He loves music. He loves the arts. So, and the Alive event, you know, I consciously brought together a variation of people. So we had Hatful of Rain, who are a local band who kind of Americana and a bit kind of countryside of things, who are brilliant musicians. We had Rich Wilson, who's a local comedian, award-winning comedian. A dear friend of mine, Robert Garnham, who lives in the West Country, came across for that one evening to perform. He's the self-titled professor of whimsy. And it's just a brilliant, brilliant poet and storyteller. And we had a chap, dear Ed Holworth, who goes under the name of Gramsci, and he's possibly the finest freestyle rapper I've ever encountered. So we had a real variation there were people that just wanted to come along and hear Bob in conversation, but there were people that wanted to hear music or comedy or poetry or whatever. So I kind of wanted to really tumble together various aspects of the arts to almost like put a marker in the sand and say, look, this is me, this is what I do, but I love all of this. Yeah, come and join us. Let's celebrate. Let's celebrate being alive, not just for me being alive, but let us all celebrate being alive and the possibilities that can give us.
Yeah, it's what we were saying at the very beginning. It's that reminder of not just positive affirmation, but the importance of balancing the crisis in the world and the crisis in our lives with those things that we can enjoy and share and connect with. And actually, there's something else you and Bob Harris have in common, in that Bob has also survived prostate cancer, which he's also being very courageous about in order to help raise awareness. And of course, Prostate Cancer UK asked you to write a poem. And this poem was shot in a football stadium. So yeah. I wondered if you could tell us about that choice.
Yeah, of course. I linked with Prostate Cancer UK in 2016. My father-in-law was given a diagnosis, and it was stage four. So he had a certain number of years, basically, and he did incredibly well. But we lost him a few years ago. So the Prostate Cancer UK basically did a charity ride from London to Amsterdam each year, and they called it Football to Amsterdam. And the idea was the first day you would turn up and you'd ride in your football shirt, and then the second day you'd ride in the Prostate Cancer UK shirt and arrive at the Ajax Arena in Amsterdam. So it was about kind of bringing, you know, teams of tribes together where that rivalry would be. But basically they had hashtag Men United. Yeah, it was just about putting all those kind of hostilities, let's call it, with football aside and tribalism aside, and just riding for the same event. So I did that, and I found it incredibly moving and empowering, and yeah, brilliant. And I wrote a couple of pieces for them, and just in the Facebook groups, and one about the medal, and which they shared. And then they actually reached out to me because they'd seen some of my other work as well, and said, look, would you consider doing a piece for us for kind of corporate partnership bids that we could record? And I'm like, yeah, of course. So yeah, I wrote that and recorded it at the Amex Stadium in Brighton, which was a surreal day, because we turned up there and it was mid-season. So they were relaying the pitch. So there were like JCBs and everything. There was quite a lot going on. And we set up the film crew and the camera crew and stuff. And then the sound man said, look, we can't record at the moment because the diggers are going and it's just too much background noise. So security guy kind of buzzed over, and then it went through to the MD. And the MD basically told all of the staff to go for an early lunch. So all the diggers stopped. And we had 45 minutes to get the piece recorded and in the can. So Brighton Hove Albion actually paused their pitch relaying so that I could record this piece for Prostate Cancer UK. And it was something incredibly close to my heart, and it came across that way, I think. And they've used it in successful corporate partnership bids, and it's helped them to raise a lot of money, but crucially a lot of awareness about the condition as well.
Yeah, and so again, this has been a huge space of personal loss, your direct experience. And time and time again, life is certainly playing you some pretty tough cards. And time again, you respond in the most positive way. And it just seems to be such a powerful testimony to your skills in poetry and spoken word, but also the power, the psychological power, the benefits of poetry. And another detail that had stood out to me around you shooting this poetry recital in a football stadium is the disease is responsible for taking one man every 45 minutes. And so you were also demonstrating scale.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was the perfect kind of setting. And it is, yeah, and I still do 1 in 8 men, and it's in the piece, 1 in 8 men in every crowd. So when you look at Match of the Day or these like big events and, you know, Olympics, Paralympics, you look at that stadium and you think 1 in 8 men in this crowd will be affected by prostate cancer.
It's
a massive, massive figure, and there's a huge awareness piece, and Prostate Cancer UK are doing brilliant things, and they've come along massively, and occasionally you'll get crossover. So I think when, you know, one of the EastEnders characters at the moment is being part of his role is that he's been diagnosed with prostate cancer. So it's coming into like the everyday and being discussed in the everyday. But it's through those rides and that work, I form friendships with people who are, you know, kind of famous, for want of a better phrase, but who have absolutely helped the charity so much. And the filming on that day was incredibly poignant, because there was a lovely, lovely man called Paul Deer that I'd ridden to Amsterdam twice with, and he had prostate cancer. And we were filming the last few shots on Brighton Beach, on the day, and I had a call from his daughter, Laura, that I'd ridden to Amsterdam with the previous year, to say that he'd passed away. So he actually passed on the day that I was recording that film, and the filming ended. So thankfully we had everything in the can, because I was not in a position to kind of carry on. But I knew he was at home with respite care. So I'd actually recorded something for him, directly to him and for him from me, in terms of our friendship and what he'd done for the charity, and sent it over as an audio file, and they played it to him the day before he passed. So it was, yeah, it was incredible. But again, it's just that reminder that you mentioned there, yeah, well, I've been dealt all these cards and things have happened, but that is just life. We are all dealt incredibly tough cards at times. And I think for me, I feel really fortunate that poetry and spoken word has helped me to kind of frame that and actually work through that. It's an incredibly supportive thing. The arts are just an incredibly supportive force for not only entertaining, but I think for actually soothing and counseling. However you want to take that word, you know, they're just vital.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the more reason for a poet chef. I love that you're a poet chef. I love the idea of a poetry takeaway. Yeah. And I guess we could think of that as soul food rather than fast food.
Oh, 100%. Yes. Liking your work. Yeah, absolutely. And it absolutely is. It's the poetry takeaway, I believe, is a kind of, I don't know, it's a giant thing waiting to happen. I've said to Michael, the guy that owns and runs it, so many times, if this was a TV program, this would reach so many people, and it would just be so vital and so brilliant. Because, you know, we've got embroidery programs and baking programs and clay programs and wood making programs. But if somebody films the poetry takeaway, people would just be talking about it, because it's such an incredible process. I mean, in effect, it's a lay-by snack van. You picture one of those. And then when the awning goes up, you've got three poets sat there.
Brilliant. I love it.
It's just such a pure thing. You have 2 or 3 minutes to get ingredients from a random person. Who do you want to phone for? What do you want it to be about? What's going on in your head at the moment? Yeah, give me some direction, da da da. You have those ingredients, and then you write them, you cook them up a poem on the spot, and they come back about 5-10 minutes later, and you read them that poem that you've just created based on their ingredients. And invariably there's tears or hugs or laughter or wow. And then you put it in an envelope, special poetry takeaway envelope, you hand it over, and you never see that poem again. But you know that person is walking away having experienced something 9 times out of 10 that they never thought was possible and they've never experienced before. And it triggers people to write and communicate and just share their truths.
You do such beautiful things, and it's all testimony to the power of poetry, the power of the arts, the reason we need to pause and reflect. In fact, how you describe the poetry takeaway, it's a bit like watching the repair shop.
Yeah, is that kind of vibe for me. I just think, I've written for... One of the ladies that sticks in my mind was, she's a granny, a nana, a Greek lady, and her son had just hit 14 and was changing in lots of ways. And she wanted a poem to him to tell him how much she loved him. And no matter what happens over the next few years, when she probably comes really annoying or embarrassing, yeah, and he has different strains and different pressures and expectations on him as he grows into a young man, she will always love him regardless of the decisions he makes. And she was scared. She was scared of losing the child, but also acknowledging he was going to become a young man. And that was like a 2 or 3 minute conversation. And then she wanders off for a coffee and you've got to write something. I had communication with her a little while after, and it's fair to say it had formed quite an important thing for her, but also for him as well. So yeah, it's just those tiny little interactions. You never know. You never know who you're talking to. You never know what stories they might have, what concerns they might have. And spoken word and poetry and the arts can just take the sting out of things sometimes, you know?
Yeah. And so everything you're saying really does feed into the end point of the series question, can art save us?
I think it is. I think it, well, I think it should. I think it can. It does. It absolutely does. That, you know, last year was, as my daughter says, sometimes lots. Yeah. Last year was lots for me. And there were times when I sat down to write and I won't share those. Yeah. They're just things I wrote at the time. Yeah. And that they will be safely, yeah, boxed away. But I needed to write. I needed to get ideas down. But likewise, you know, last year was lots, and yet, you know, we got alive together down at Rockwater in Hove, yeah, and we performed and celebrated being alive, yeah, and that could not happen if you didn't have, you know, disparate people living all over Sussex and out to the West Country who had a passion to perform and share stories. And we all came together that night and proved that the arts can save us. Yeah, it's so simple in my mind. It's so clear in my mind. And as I say, I think lockdown is the most telling point in the last few years that what we retreated to naturally and instinctively, yeah, was the arts.
Yeah. It just had a genuine space to reveal itself.
Absolutely. It supported people. It helped people. Yeah. It got people through something that no one, hopefully there won't be any other events that affects the entire world at the same time. Yeah, it was a massive, massive, massive event. But the arts, I believe, just played such an important part in helping people to get through each day, because that's what it was, wasn't it? There was a point, it was just like day by day, what are we going to do today? What are we allowed to do today? What can we do today? And the arts, for me and so many other people, just formed part of that support mechanism.
Absolutely. And you too, Dave, are playing a massive part in helping people get through their daily lives. Your generosity is huge. I know you're too modest to say, as is your courage. We don't often recognize courage because it's so often perceived as trumpet blowing for heroism, but it's the courage to persist in the right thing, to find the strength to have positive affirmation. And as you were saying throughout the interview, to spread the light and to spread the joy. I really do want to say a huge thank you, not just for your time today, but for the generosity that you're sharing through your work, that you're reaching people with. Listeners will be able to find your Week in Words on BBC Sounds, and that will be via the Alison Ferns breakfast show on a Sunday. And there's three counties where, for listeners in the UK, you can tune in for Kent, Sussex and Surrey. But online, head to BBC Sounds. On Dave's dedicated episode page, I will be sure to point you to the relevant link so you can discover more of his work and hopefully join the benefits of what Dave has taught us today, the benefits of poetry and the fact that we can find joy. Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate it.
No, this has been fun. This has been, yeah, just this has been a happy, you can hear I'm smiling, right? You can hear it in my voice. I'm just smiling. This is lovely. And what you're doing is incredible and vital. And all power to you.
Bless you. Well, thank you for being part of it, Dave.
It's an absolute privilege. Thank you.